This is the St. Sophia Russian Orthodox Cathedral. Less than a mile across town is Joseph Stalin Park. The winters are freezing cold. The economy dominated by oil. Strangely, this is not Russia. This is China's northwestern province of Heilongjiang, located just 50 miles above North Korea. Not so long ago, this was the beating heart of the Chinese economy. It supplied the hard physical resources, coal, oil, and gas, the country needed to industrialize. And thanks to its importance, the region basked in the warm, golden glow of the party's favor. This statue commemorates one of Mao's model socialist workers, nicknamed Iron Man for his tireless work on a nearby oil field. Then, one day, China moved on. Sometime around 10 years ago, the country changed focus. Dirty, dangerous, and environmentally destructive industries were out. Meanwhile, technology, innovation, and high-skilled labor were in. This was no polite suggestion, nor was this transition slow and methodical. This sweeping economic restructuring was executed with all the force and velocity of an unchecked authoritarian regime. The message was unambiguous and unforgiving. Robots are the future. Adapt or be left behind. Foxconn, famous for assembling the iPhone, began building what it ominously called a 1 million robot army. Taxes were cut by 40% for tech companies. And one province announced it would spend $70 billion to replace workers with robots. These were not empty threats. In 2022, nearly six times more industrial robots were installed in China than any other country. And by nearly every metric, this transformation has been successful. Between 2010 and 2020, its economy doubled in size and its population grew by 76 million people. China is bigger, stronger, and richer today than it was a decade ago. But what's often overlooked amidst this Rise of China National Renaissance narrative is who was overlooked. Not everyone was invited aboard this high-speed train to modernity. By very explicitly selecting new winners, the party dismissed others as losers. Just as globalization favored coastal cities like New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, China's new economic order favored rich urban areas like Shanghai, Hangzhou, and Shenzhen. Today's model socialist workers are Tesla-driving, high-rise living data scientists and engineers. Left behind are China's West Virginias, Detroits, and Pittsburghs, collectively home to 100 million people. These depressed cities remain frozen in time, relics of an earlier era, with their depleted oil fields and Soviet-era cathedrals. In that same decade between 2010 and 20, while most of the country was bursting at the seams with growth, Heilongjiang actually shrank. In 2021, just 3.5 children were born there for every 1,000 residents, less than half the national average. And if America's Rust Belt was forgotten, China's was flat out rejected. While Americans are, at least legally, free to pick up and move to new opportunities, Chinese workers have no such luxury. Because public services in China are restricted to your place of birth, these migrants can't access healthcare, pensions, or education in their new cities. Even their children are banned from attending local schools. In other words, those unlucky enough to be born in China's Rust Belt today are permanent second-class citizens in their own country. So, here's a puzzle. Why aren't they angry? Why, after being replaced by robots, do these same workers maintain such positive views about automation? Out of 54 countries, China ranks second highest in agreement that more emphasis on technology is a good thing, and fourth highest for science and technology bring more opportunities for the next generation. China is twice as optimistic about the future as any other country, and six times as optimistic as the US. Why? Sponsored by Nebula, the exclusive home to China Actually, my seven-part original series. A lot has changed in China over the last 100 years, but one thing has not. Its objective to catch up and surpass the United States. It's hard to say where this competitive mindset originates. But we do know that Chinese leaders are big believers in grand historical narratives. Xi Jinping loves to repeat cliches like the East is rising and the West is declining. In the party's version of history, Western imperialist powers once exploited their advanced technology, firearms and naval instruments, for example, to humiliate the Chinese Empire. The British stole Hong Kong, the Portuguese Macau, and the French, among others, Shanghai. These traumatic chapters, it seems, led Chinese leaders to view history as a one-way, zero-sum, linear race. A race it's currently losing. To overtake the US, therefore, it needs to somehow accelerate, to employ some kind of force multiplier. China calls this overtaking on a bend. While a more cautious driver like Washington might slow down as it approaches a sharp curve in the road, Beijing, on the other hand, must fearlessly accelerate. Until recently, this meant overlooking the consequences of rapid industrialization. If America enforced labor laws, China saw its asymmetrical advantage as ignoring them. A culture of build fast and break things at a national scale. It also meant quickly and indiscriminately adopting Western technology, especially after Mao's death in the 1970s. The party at the time faced a serious problem. On one hand, everyone could see that Mao's Great Leap Forward had been an unmitigated disaster, accomplishing little and killing millions in the process. On the other, it certainly couldn't condemn its own founder and hero, the literal face of the party. Ultimately, the way it lawyered itself out of this embarrassing dilemma went like this. While Mao's goals were noble, his methods may have been flawed. With a few tweaks here and there, China would be back on track. The Communist Party was still relevant because only it had the scientific and technocratic expertise to make those adjustments. Its performance would now be based more on its material than its ideological success. And this success would largely be measured by the number of smartphones in people's hands, robots on factory floors, and miles of high-speed rail. In the process, technology took on an almost supernatural aura. It became the magic bullet to all of China's problems. Its state religion, if you will. Naturally, this led to lightning-fast adoption. The country went straight from cash to mobile payments, from fax machines to iPhones. In its quest to catch up, it skipped right over checks, credit cards, pagers, and BlackBerries. But this infatuation with technology also made it vulnerable to digital snake oil, waste, fraud, and false promises. To see why, watch how all this plays out on the ground, as these grand aspirations trickle down through the party's 40 million person bureaucracy. First, Xi Jinping wakes up one day and declares, "Robots are the future." But although his authority is unlimited, his ability to execute this vision is limited. He himself can't make or buy or regulate these robots. The central government, therefore, delegates the how to its what down to local governments. To incentivize their cooperation, Beijing promotes or demotes these officials based on quantifiable metrics, say how many robots they install. And eager to get that corner office, boy, will they install some robots. As a rule, when China's goals are easily measured, file more patents, graduate more engineers, or produce cheaper solar panels, you can pretty confidently bet on its success. Indeed, as you can see, digital technology has grown from 14% of its economy in 2005 to a remarkable 39% in 2020. That's what China is good at. These incentives allow it to go from napkin sketch to completed skyscraper in no time flat. But when its goals are intangible or more subjective, like winning hearts and minds around the globe, it tends to struggle. It's easy to build more robots. It's a lot harder to make sure they're put to good use. Now, make no mistake, much of this 39% of China's economy is productive. As the government dumped billions of dollars worth of subsidies on the tech sector, some of it landed on your Huawei's, your TikToks, your Xiaomi's. But for every TikTok, there are 10 million terminally unprofitable metaverse startups. For every Huawei, there are 10 billion nebulous smart city initiatives. You name a gimmick, scam, or buzzword, and the Chinese government has almost certainly invested an alarming number of zeros in it. Last July, for instance, the city of Shanghai announced it would spend over $1 billion on the metaverse. A few years earlier, this futuristic bus went viral for solving the problem of gridlock by gliding over traffic. Unfortunately, it was later exposed as a pyramid scheme, but not before five Chinese cities signed contracts with the company. Now, no country is immune to misplaced optimism. Remember solar roadways? In fact, who pioneered the metaverse craze but Facebook, an American company? But if Silicon Valley wins the award for inventing the most cutting-edge snake oil, China wins the award for buying the most. Time after time after time, China eagerly imports these wasteful speculative innovations and then proceeds to dig the deepest possible money pit. Part of the problem is that private companies take advantage of the government's faith in technology. Why would they question the usefulness of all these gadgets when they're being handed billions of dollars worth of subsidies? Assessing the utility of cutting-edge inventions is hard enough. Doubly so for a 70-year-old with no technical background. And triply so when you've constructed an intricate bureaucracy of 40 million yes-men with no incentive to give negative feedback. As a result, it takes a long time for reality to catch up with the country's leaders. And therefore, when it finally does, it often provokes a swift and brutal overcorrection. Recall that it began shifting focus from heavy industry to tech sometime around 2010. For the next decade, China's Silicon Valley enjoyed its moment in the spotlight. It, like coal, oil, and gas before it, basked in the party's favor. Companies like Baidu, Tencent, and Alibaba exploited this boundless enthusiasm and cheap capital to grow bigger and bigger. They started making riskier bets. They entered wildly unrelated markets, and their CEOs became dangerously popular. Then, after 10 years, the fun came screeching to a halt as the party realized the monster it had created. And in 2020, it sprung into action, breaking up the largest companies and regulating them like never before. To be clear, the party hasn't lost its faith in technology. This crackdown was about steering the industry toward what it calls high-quality or productive growth. Think less internet gambling and Fortnite and loan sharks, and more semiconductors, EVs, and robots. In fact, China really has no choice but to double down on technology. In 2021, its population began to shrink, and this decline is especially pronounced among the working age, those roughly 18 to 65. Meanwhile, Chinese labor, once among the cheapest in the world, is now four times as expensive as neighboring countries like Thailand and the Philippines. Unsurprisingly, many companies have responded by shifting their production to those cheaper places. Each year, fewer and fewer Chinese workers are employed in manufacturing. All these factory workers have to find new jobs somewhere. And tech is one of the few areas of growth. As you can see, the decline in manufacturing has coincided with a rapid rise in labor-intensive service jobs. These are your Uber drivers, your live streamers, and your DoorDash delivery people. So that's why the government must continue embracing technology. But this still leaves one important question. Why do workers? After all, the jump from assembling iPhones to delivering meals isn't all that great of a promotion. These are still low-paid and surprisingly dangerous jobs. Because delayed orders are heavily penalized, for example, Chinese delivery people are prone to extremely reckless driving. Serious injuries and even deaths are shockingly common. Never mind that these aren't, strictly speaking, jobs. They're independent contractor arrangements that can and do disappear at a moment's notice. China's largest platforms can change their contracts with drivers without their consent. Now, that's the most vulnerable end of the spectrum. But even the luckiest, most privileged workers, programmers, and engineers are overworked and underpaid. Some work what's widely known in China as a 996 schedule, meaning 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. In other words, workers are either excluded from the labor market, like we saw in Heilongjiang, or abused, as in the case of urban, highly educated programmers. Neither are paid as well as their counterparts across the globe. When even the winners are treated so poorly, one wonders why workers don't complain. The obvious answer, of course, is that they do, yet their voices are censored. Another explanation is that the public only hears good stories about technology, thanks to the party's control of the media. Both these things are true. There's no doubt censorship and propaganda play a massive role. But theories alone are no substitute for real-world, on-the-ground research. At some point, it helps to just ask. And that's exactly what Yawen Lei did for her book The Gilded Cage. What she found in interview after interview is that Chinese programmers are aware of their unusually stressful working conditions. But they situate their personal hardships within a larger context, the nation's development. One engineer said, quote, "If Chinese people worked from 9 to 5 like people in developed countries, we wouldn't have so many accomplishments." And another, "China remains a developing country. I don't think the government can do anything if we want to catch up with developed countries." Put differently, their low monetary wages are offset by a kind of psychological wage, pride. This is why Xi Jinping loves to repeat platitudes like "the East is rising and the West is declining." These narratives buy the party incredible leeway. All is forgiven in the name of progress. Chinese tech workers aren't exploited. They're part of something bigger than themselves. Many of the darkest chapters in Chinese history have been justified by this vague notion of national progress, from the Great Leap Forward to the one-child policy. Even today, it's widely assumed that the latter was effective, necessary, and helpful. Three myths that I challenge in the latest episode of my series, China Actually. In it, we also explore questions like how was the policy enforced, who was and wasn't affected, and how does China's birth rate compare to nearby countries like Taiwan? The one-child policy was among humanity's most ambitious attempts at social engineering, and yet so little is known about it today. You can watch the entire series, which also covers myths like that China lifted 800 million people out of poverty, or that it's secretly building thousands of underground nuclear bombs, on Nebula. Nebula is the streaming platform built by and for creators. It's also home to other great originals like Real Life Lore's Modern Conflicts, which explains many of the 21st century's most important wars, and Wendover Productions' fascinating series The Logistics of X. Now, normally Nebula costs $5 a month, but you can get it for just half that by signing up for a year with a link on screen or in the description now. That's just $2.50 a month for loads of exclusive content you'll love.